The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, and welcome to This Week in the Ancient Near East, the podcast that takes archaeology exactly as seriously as it deserves. I'm Alex Jaffe, director of the Bob and Ray Institute of Archaeology at the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoople. Once again, I appear to be suddenly joined, as usual, by two real academics from actual institutions, Professor J.P. Dessel of the University of Tennessee and Professor Rachel Hallett of the State University of New York at Purchase. We're coming to you, once again, from the tasting room at the Boone's Farm Institute of Oenology, dedicated to putting fine southern North Dakotan wines on the map, here on the beautiful Hoople campus. This week, we're talking about the discovery of grape pips at late antique Avdat in the northern Negev, which has us wondering about, well, grapes and wine. We've long known that well-regarded and widely exported wines were made in the northern Negev, but new research has provided a more specific chronology, showing that the wine industry did continue from the late Byzantine period into the early Islamic period, and the profile of the wine itself. One of the pips was from a white grape whose closest modern relative is a variety still grown in Lebanon. So how does a wine industry arise in an arid zone? Did it start as a monastery making wine for itself, an enclave of traditions and technologies, which found that it had a winner on its hands? Isn't it all really about marketing? Just how did you make it known in antiquity that you produce a tasty wine? Were there street corner wine tastings? Was the reputation just developed by supply and demand? Or were there middlemen involved? All we know is, you like what you like. We'll go straight to the lightning round. And I have several possibilities, but I think in the interest of national security, we'll go with the simple one. Red or white?
Wine.
I don't even think we could be talking about blood cells.
That's true.
I just think we need to answer the question without regard to any greater degree of typology.
My answer for blood cells would be different than my answer for wine, I think.
Well, you got to choose which you want to answer.
No, my answer is the same, actually.
I'm agnostic when it comes to blood cells.
As long as you have them.
Right. And as long as they're not rosé. My answer is red. I don't even have to think about it.
Okay. My answer is also red.
Yeah, me too.
So who's drinking all this white wine?
We have a friend who only drinks white wine. But white wine gives me a hammering headache.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Something about, and that the worst hangover I ever got, which actually resulted in my buying a piece of art. That's a story for another time.
Or maybe no time.
Or another broadcast. No time like the present. Well, the year was.
I used to like white wine before it used to give me headaches. There was a period.
Yeah. I mean, in hot weather, a very cold glass of white wine, delightful.
Although rosés are also good in hot weather.
Rosés.
Well, Beaujolais are chilled. Beaujolais in hot weather is, for me,
oh,
what I like.
I've only had unchilled in cold weather.
Delicately heated Beaujolais.
I mean, when someone orders Chardonnay, I literally just stare at them. Like, what are you doing? How can you drink that stuff?
Right.
But that's just me.
Okay.
What about Grenache? You have the same negative.
No, just Chardonnay is my most negative visceral reaction.
Because it's become a kind of trope.
No, I've always just the taste.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that whatever. What is it? Oaky? It's an oaky taste, right?
I guess.
I prefer to separate my trees and my vines.
Fair enough. What about, well, how do you feel about Rieslings?
Not so good.
No. No, so the sweeter, dessertier kinds of things, not for you.
No, if they could.
No, not sweet.
If I could drink dust and have it taste like wine, I would do that.
It's the official flavor profile of New Jersey wines, I guess. No, I'm sure they make good New Jersey wines. Please don't sue.
Yeah.
Don't sue us.
All right, let's move on here.
Okay. Somebody else introduced this one.
Well, why have we called you here today? To discuss flavor preferences? No. But because, as I like to say, the boffins are at it again. And thanks to very, 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 very careful excavation and sifting and sieving and analysis and extracting things with little tweezers, grape pips in this case, from late antique Avdat in the Negev have been extracted and analyzed. And wouldn't you know it, this one sample seems to be a white wine. But why is this important? We knew that they drank wine in antiquity.
Is that rhetorical? I don't know if it's a rhetorical question.
Well, it's or more of
an actual question. I'm a little lost here.
Yeah.
I couldn't get any social cues from the intonation.
I think this is very interesting because, as we know, there are, you know, the drinking of the fruit of the grape goes back many, many, many thousands of years to the Neolithic, to Iran and Georgia, the Black Sea area.
Let's not start a war in the Caucasus by not giving Georgia their due.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is the central pillar of Georgian tourism.
Well, yeah. We'll give them that. We'll give them that that honor.
Right. Well, I mean, Prima. One thing I read was that at least one scholar, probably many, think that grapes have mainly been grown for wine. And I was thinking, really? I mean, I like to serve grapes as dessert also. You know, it's not just for winemaking. What do you guys think?
No, I think there was ample mention of grapes being consumed, raisins being made and consumed, and wine.
Yeah. Okay. Because I like the thought of just taking the grapes and trampling them. I like to think that we're using grapes for other things.
Well, I think that we're entitled to think that.
A very useful suggestion for anyone out there who's just seeing grapes and making wine out of them without. You can also eat them.
Right, exactly.
handy tip from the SUNY Extension Bureau.
And we talked about that freezer at Lagash. You can also freeze grapes for a delightful repast in hot summer weather.
Yes, actually. A
frozen grape.
Yeah, that's quite.
But let's tease this out a little more, I think, so that our listener is going to stay with us. So they've reanalyzed, or they've analyzed grape pips from Avdat dating to the Byzantine period into the early Islamic period.
Right.
So roughly the 4th through sort of 7th centuries CE. And they found, and part of the rationale for this was pure research to try to find out a little bit more about Byzantine trade networks, creation of commercial wine production in the southern Levant, the export of these wines throughout the eastern Mediterranean and into Europe, the relationship between European varietals and these earlier Middle Eastern, Near Eastern varietals. But there's also a very practical application of this kind of research, and that is the technology used and the varieties created in the southern Levant in the Byzantine period is in a very arid region, And this aridity, these, you know, adapted varieties to high arid zones could be instructive going forward with a warmer environment and, you know, global warming to the sort of, you know, sustaining wine production into the later 21st century. In other words, we need to know how to grow the crops that we're dependent on in warmer weather. And so there's a lot here. And in this case, there's a sort of a direct correlation between what our ancient descendants were doing and applying that to the modern world.
One of the interesting things that I never fully processed was that there are only 11 grape cultivars on which, you know, the vast majority of from which the vast majority of wine in the world is made, you know, Cabernet and Chardonnay and Grenache and Merlot and blah blah blah. But there are thousands of varieties of grape all over the place, and the grape is pretty much ubiquitous in Europe, Asia, Western Asia, and also in North America. And and it grows in all these different micro environments, you know, from colder to warmer and to all sorts of soil conditions and aridity and all this kind of stuff. So,
yeah, no, that was very interesting. And, you know, when I was reading this at first, I was thinking the sample size is so small, and it is a small sample size, but
we're talking about a handful of pips,
right? They found, I believe they worked on 16 pips, but half of them were used for carbon-14 dating and the other half were used for ancient DNA.
Well, in some cases, and this I found very interesting, they would split the pip and do both forms of analysis. And I want to know a little bit about, you know, the technology behind pip splitting, because that's one very, very, very sharp blade. And that reminded me of that study done on obsidian blades versus stainless steel blade scalpels. And doctors, surgeons who were part of this study found that obsidian scalpels were far sharper than their metal analogs.
Well, that's interesting. I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but wouldn't the obsidian blades break more easily? I mean,
maybe, but you know.
Okay. Anyway,
they're sharper.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
Good question for another day.
Exactly.
And if our listener happens to be a surgeon, please write in or call in. Operators are standing by now.
Yeah.
I'm sure just they had the intern do it with, you know, an X-Acto knife or something. But
right. All right. Let's stay back to it.
But in any case, even though it was a small sample size, they did get some really interesting results. That was what I was going to say.
Yep.
Right. I think though that they're sort of missing the important point here, the important archaeological point. And yeah, there are all these grapes from Avdat from the late Byzantine, early Islamic period are grown in these wacky conditions by, you know, sort of contemporary standards, very arid overall conditions, rocky soil, cold nights, super hot days, this sort of thing. But conversely, the vast majority of grapes that are grown for wine are grown in this narrow band of soil conditions, climate conditions, from only 11 primary varieties. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is homogenization that, you know, homogenization of genetic variability to create commercial products that have, you know, reliable and predictable characteristics. And this is something that goes back thousands of years, in fact, because they're exported, grape great producers, wine producers, by the Roman period, by the Iron Age, even earlier, are producing reliable, consistent product based on a limited number of varieties that they found to be nice and productive. And, you know, they've squozen out all of these local variations. The writers of this thing, of this piece, used a great phrase, disjointed micro populations, which I kind of love. I want to use that elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it's the old story of globalization, in a sense, producing this product with local variations being kind of pushed to the margins, like the highlands of the Negev or something.
Yeah.
And now we've rediscovered the utility of these products because they're great and because they're useful and because the situation demands it.
Right. So I want to give a little bit of historical basis or context to this, because we know from historical sources of the Byzantine period that wine was exported from Byzantine Palestine, and that it mainly came from the ports of Gaza and Ashkelon. And we also know from archaeology, and we know also that wine, some of it anyway, came from the Negev, was manufactured in the Negev. And then we know from, and this actually really fascinates me, from archaeology of various Mediterranean port cities in Southern Europe, that you have ceramics of a Gazaware type jar that transported wine that ended up all over the Mediterranean. So we have other historical, archaeological globalization evidence before we even started doing this ancient DNA stuff.
Right. There are historical accounts of Roman emperors or a Roman emperor who had half the vineyards in southern France destroyed because they were competing with product from Italy. And I don't know what variety of wine there was. And obviously, if you go to Rome today or any, you know, Italian port city, you'll see piles of sherds from amphora, you know, a mile high. So vast was the trade in that particular period. So again, it's globalization, but it's also, globalization comes with a price, and that's vulnerability of the product itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big issue today about having, you know, crops with very little genetic diversity and being susceptible to either heat or, you know, pests, or becoming immune to certain pesticides, and what's going to happen. And this is the whole GMO argument, and it's sort of, you know, the problem with these huge, big, you know, multinational corporations like Monsanto. They're creating.
Yeah, but in the grape world, it goes back even further.
Right.
And I the one bit of research that I did that I allowed myself was to read up a little bit on the phylloxera crisis of the 19th century, where English botanists imported North American grapevines to England and Europe, which had the phylloxera bug on them.
Ooh, okay.
Which proceeded in a matter of only a few decades to wipe out something like, you know, 60 to 90% of all French wineries.
Oh dear.
And which was only solved by importing bug resistant root stocks from North America and planting them in France.
Huh.
So once again, it was probably the first time that America came to the rescue of France. And and they grafted all these different varieties onto the rootstocks, which are resistant to the bugs.
So they have the original strains of vines because they just used the roots. But
correct.
Yeah. Interesting.
Again, you know, sort of global trade and its agonists.
Yeah. Well, one other thing that was kind of a subtext in this article was the change from the Byzantine Empire to the Umayyad, to the Islamic Empire, because a lot of things changed or are thought to have changed with the coming of Islam. And you're kind of shaking your head in a not.
Well,
so-
I mean, I think that that's the traditional view,
right?
Because so that's the because the historical narrative suggests big sociological differences. But as we're learning in all of these periods, you know, change comes from within.
Right.
It happens slowly. Usually.
Right. And that was sort of one of the points towards the end of this article that I wanted to point out that they say, so if I was understanding the beginning of the article correctly, the stratum of dot, that it was on above a Byzantine floor, but a floor which, but the context was Islamic.
Sort of waffle a little bit, because my sense is that the samples are C14 dated to the 7th century.
Right.
Right. And that's really right at the transition.
Exactly. Exactly. So they were, and they were here. I wrote down a quote from the article. We are unable to directly relate the sequenced early Islamic Avdat great pips to the Byzantine Negev wine industry. However, they did make a connection. And I think this is important that the type of rainwater cultivation they were doing that was at its peak in the Byzantine period clearly continued into the Islamic period. So right. It's exactly your point that things really didn't change radically with the coming of
at least, right. I mean, you know, there is change, obviously, but at places like Avdat, you know, there's probably a chunk of time in which things are, you know, sort of staying the same and slowly changing, and, you know, things change in unpredictable but systematic ways. You know,
right.
Political change doesn't necessarily mean economic change. Economic change might follow. And obviously what we're talking about here is Islamic prohibitions against drinking and the production of wine. But we know that, you know, there are Christians and Jews who continue to produce and drink wine. And we also know that, you know, undoubtedly lots of early Muslims were also probably partaking until the prohibition really became, you know, more culturally accepted and, you know, more deeply embedded within the, you know, landscape, both
right.
Figuratively and literally.
And this particular site, or this place within Avdat anyway, where these were found, is associated with some sort of Christian, even if it's post-Byzantine, Christian monastic something or other. It was associated with the building, right? It was associated with the building with religious wall paintings.
And I think that one of the little pieces of the article mentions how specialized wineries, and they're talking about contemporary specialized wineries and monasteries, are using these.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know, are using a wider palette of varieties than what, Alex, you mentioned earlier, the 11, you know, the 11 big industrial varieties.
The noble varieties.
The noble
varieties.
The ignoble varieties. And so what's interesting there is monasteries as these bastions or centers or nodes of ancient technology, ancient varieties, all sorts of things that have been sort of lost over the last 1,000 years, maybe get preserved in these little, you know, these little enclaves.
Yeah.
And so we can think about monasteries in a much different way. Monasteries as places where ancient knowledge and ancient technologies and ancient varieties of, you know,
they're literally, in this case, a kind of, some of them, a refugium for, you know, otherwise defunct species or varieties.
Right. Right. But now, and now they're coming, and now they can sort of, you know, they're being revivified
right.
as places that, you know, maintain these traditions. And now we need those traditions, because now in order to meet, you know, the needs of the global wine market, we're going to have to start making wine in much more arid zones.
Right.
And so these monasteries, you know, have a lot of proprietorial intellectual property that they can utilize and play on. And that's a really interesting kind of thing. So, yeah.
And together with that, and it's something I read, but I probably read it on Wikipedia, so I don't know where the piece of information comes
absolutely
from.
Authoritative.
Don't ever say that in public.
I know, but I want to be honest, because I didn't look
no,
up.
No, never be honest.
I didn't trace it back. Honest. Anyway, that in the Byzantine period, wine made in the Holy Land appealed to priests to use in communion, while we're talking about this religious thread. So it, there was, even though it was not, you know, it lasted even when there were called the 11 noble. Yeah. Yeah. So in other words,
the
it had
noble its truths and the 11 noble culture varietals.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, even it's small, but it's important. That was the point to religious folk.
So we can only say here, man, oh, Manischewitz.
Oh boy, you had that in your back pocket. I didn't.
I know. I wrote it down earlier.
That's a good one.
It is a good one. Never gets old.
Well, but there's also one of my questions from all this is obviously what this wine tasted like.
Ah,
and yes, it's a white wine. We kind of know what white wine tastes like.
Well, there was just one example that was white. But let me just interrupt you for a second. I think we should emphasize we've mentioned it, but we should emphasize that this Negev wine had an international reputation,
right?
Was being exported and used from South Arabia to Egypt to Europe to East Africa, and so this stuff was whatever it tasted like, it was well regarded.
Yes. Yes.
And now, right. And it should be mentioned that the closest relative to this white wine is the Aswad Karech variety, which is still found and made in Lebanon, which I've never had. But
and Greece.
And then later into Crete. Right. Greece and Crete. Yeah.
Right. And I thought that was actually fascinating. So, Alex, if you want to taste it, I think we can probably find you some. We might have to go to Greece.
We have to go to one of the big liquor stores. Okay. I'll just get on Drizzly or something and see if they can deliver it tomorrow.
And in fact, there was some speculation about this the modern Greek thing that derives from the Aswad Karech variety it's also called Siriki, which might derive from the word Syria or from Sarki in Arabic, or alternately might derive from the word Sorek, which apparently is, well, we know about the Sorek Valley.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think more importantly, the Aswad Karech variety is found in Latakia. Or ultimately it is found in Latakia. And so there's this, you know, coastal Lebanon, Syria area, region for this particular variety, which then later finds a home in Greece and Crete.
Better put.
Right. So what does it say about the evolution, not simply of trade, but of taste preferences?
Oh, that's interesting.
And, you know, we all kind of know what a Burgundy tastes like, and there are a million different producers of Burgundy. We all know what a Merlot tastes like.
Who drinks Merlot?
not us.
You know, there was a very good wine movie where that, you know,
what was that called? Sideways.
With I can't remember his name, but yeah, where they really
Paul Giamatti.
That's it. Thank you. Paul Giamatti, where he really, really slams Merlot.
Right. And that's a great example, because Merlot is one of the classic varieties. And here you, but for whatever reason, it became kind of a, you know, kind of a middle-class suburban, you know, cliche at some point in the early 20th century. And then it was parodied in this, movie. And I don't know
how no one drinks it.
I was about to say, I don't know how where low sales are, and we would be happy to plug it.
That's right.
If our listener was in the wine business, but you know, so how do these things get their reputations?
Well, that's a really, I mean, that is a huge complicated issue, and you know,
particularly in the ancient world.
Well, I don't think it's any less complicated now.
Well, this is actually so now, you know, you have to have a wine tasting and people have the palates are specifically trained and you have to be an expert and you have to know everything and the bouquet and all the stuff that I know nothing about. But most of us just drink wine because we like it. And some of us can't really tell the difference between a $15 bottle and a $100 bottle in terms of taste or, you know, it's an elitist kind of a thing. So,
but it's been made middle class.
Yeah.
Well, it's elitist in the sense that it's a signifier of social status. You know, I drink my wine from a bottle, not a box.
Eric Asimov will write an article saying that boxed wine is superior to.
It's actually better.
Right, and you know this happened when wine started producing twist off tops, and it was, you know, those were shunned by the viterate, and then it came to be known that no. Twist off tops in many ways, especially for middle range wines, are much better because you really get assured that you're not going to get a whatever spoiled bottle.
Right.
And so, you know, all of these things change, but I think there's a couple of things that are important. And this applies to a wide range of subjective kinds of experiences. So for those of us, you know, who grew up with speakers, what's the best speaker? Well, the best speaker is the one that you like. You know, what's the most beautiful Persian or, you know, Southwest Asian carpet? It's the one that you like,
right?
Ultimately.
Right.
And I think
but we don't all agree on the things that we don't like.
Well, you like what you like.
Right.
Yes, but what about the things that you don't like?
I think this tastes
like crap.
Right, you don't like it.
Mean that there's not an elitist market and that things don't kind of get blown up.
Stratified.
And what people think is good is known, you know, that's what drives prices up. You know, like think of the art market.
Right. Well, and art is the most extreme example of this.
Right.
But there's marketing. So marketing, I think, plays a huge role. And I suspect it played an equally huge role, you know, probably without the degree of refinement in the ancient world. So there's marketing. And then marketing tells us what we like and what we don't like. And what am I trying to say here? Is it marketing creates audiences and creates, you know, the taste palette.
Yeah.
And then there's the economic or financial side of things. I mean, if you only drink a $180 bottle of bourbon once.
Yeah.
You won't have the palate refinement to say, oh yeah, that's a really great bourbon compared to a $40 bottle of bourbon. But if you can only afford a $25 bottle of bourbon, then you can find perfectly respectable $25 bottles of bourbon. So it's a very complicated mix. And let's not deceive ourselves. If you go over to someone's house and you want to impress them, you'll bring an expensive bottle of wine, regardless of how it tastes, because you probably never tasted it.
That's probably true. Now, how can you're absolutely right. So how can we apply this to the ancient world, to the Byzantine world?
We can either say that those same kinds of imperatives are in force. And I would suspect that they are. So yeah. The reputation that Central Negev wines had for export was probably due in part to the exporters themselves saying, yeah, this is a great wine, right, and making it available.
Well, so how would that have worked? The Central Negev Wine Producers Association, you know, gets up a fund to send 10 amphora to the coast, and they set up a little booth. Here, try this wine.
No, I don't think
so. Get a buzz going.
I don't think you can refine it down to those kinds of levels. We're never going to know. I think it's more like a big importer exporter somewhere on some coast someplace, let's say Gaza, but it could equally be Cyprus, or it could be someplace on the Red Sea, because East Africa is getting these wines, has a big consignment of this stuff from the Central Negev, and they want to get rid of it. So they price it accordingly, and they literally just ship it and talk it up when they get to this port. And it was respectable enough so that people drank it. And one of the, I guess, important features of the article that we didn't really discuss is that the height of these Central Negev wines is from what, the 5th to the mid 6th century.
Right.
So roughly around 150 years, but that the industry itself lasted longer than that.
Yeah.
And so it lasts until there's no longer buy-in from the market.
Right. But
clearly there was at least a century and a half where this stuff was highly regarded.
Right. So question is, how do and this is the question that we ask pretty much every episode. How do markets and producers know about each other? Or they just know because it's in the air. You know, the tin farmers of Afghanistan, or no, sorry, Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan. Right. No mean notes, please.
Let's not.
How do they know, like, 10,000 miles to the west, there's a market?
Well, that's having a viral moment. That's all.
But there's also a little difference because there's less subjectivity about tin. You need tin to make bronze. It doesn't taste good. It has to be of a certain quality so that the bronze is okay. But it's far less subjective. So tin is like, we need tin. Where can we get it? Oh, it's coming in from the east. We don't know where. But all of this subjective stuff, and it can expand to the taste of grapes and to the taste of especially raisins, right? So if you go to these big Central Asian, you know, market cities like Kashgar or Turfan, when I went to Turfan, there were like 18 varieties of raisins, right? And it was like, whoa, what's going on here? Lots and lots of different kinds of raisins. And I tasted as many varieties as I could, but if you only taste something once or twice, you're never going to develop that palate.
Well, that's true. And I really think it's something between what the two of you are saying. It's not let's set up a booth at the port city and, you know, promote our wine. And it's not let's get rid of our wine because we have an overstock. Let's reduce the price. I think it's somewhere in between. I think it's somehow or other, and I don't know how, it got out that this is a reasonably priced, good tasting wine. And people started to like it. And it's also a little bit, you know, it's being grown in this arid region, and it has maybe
exotic
it has
characteristics.
Different, what characteristics?
Exotic
characteristics. Either it tastes different, or just the fact that it's grown in this arid region makes it kind of cool. And it went viral sometime in the, I don't know, 5th century, and people started to know about it and liked it. And also in terms of the end of the, you know, I mentioned the coming of Islam, but let's not forget about the Justinian Plague of 541, I think it started.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah, I looked that up, obviously. But you know, that also killed a lot of people, changed markets, at least temporarily, right? So the decline can be seen, you know, mid-6th century decline, and then things change again in the 7th century. But I just think it's kind of a bit of a viral moment for the wine, this particular wine in this particular moment.
Okay, but
You're never going to be happy with these answers. You're always going to be, you know, because we're never going to know.
Never going to know.
I realize that. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. because if we go elsewhere in the Negev, and we stay with our late antique.
Yeah.
These caravanserai where they have you know shellfish and stuff that we talked about in episode 197B or whatever it was.
And if you subscribe, you can get access to all the episodes.
That's right. Special decoder ring. So there's the process, sort of captured in its garbage, in its leavings, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And now, this winery, these grape pips are kind of the origin point for a trade, which then went somewhere north, south, east, west. And, those being really the only possible directions it could go to, up and down being completely out of the realm of possibility at that point.
Right.
The Byzantine mole people weren't taking down long shoots.
Right, the balloon people weren't taking it to stratosphere.
Right.
So well, no, you that, produce. Look, you're a wine producer. You produce wine. You put it in jar. You say, now what do I do with it? Okay, just go.
Well, this is something else that we've discussed a lot, and what I think is crucial and continues to resonate and exist today. And that's the money is in the logistics. The money is in the people who can connect production to markets. And I think it's those people with that logistical expertise. And Alex, you and I have been talking about logistical expertise since writing our dissertations and the establishment of the Egyptian state in the Egypto-Canaanite relations. So, right.
And we were there. That's how old
exactly.
We
were there. But it's this logistical expertise that you see played out in Breaking Bad in the most eloquent way, right? I mean, I think Breaking Bad is the best way to sort of understand the ins and outs and importance of logistical
expertise. That's a good point. So it's the middlemen who bring the word
and the
backing,
and they make the money.
Right.
They make it work and they make the money
because they assume the most risk.
Yeah.
Right. Because they're involved in actually moving these big bulky materials. But I think also just to finish, and then Rachel, you can go. It's these people with logistical expertise who are doing the marketing because they assume so much risk in the shipment, the transshipment of these big bulky things, that they're the ones that have to come up with logos and titles and the idea and have the charisma to sell these products because they take on so much risk. When you take on risk, you get very creative and you get very wed to the process of really creating and maintaining a secure market. So I think it's the people on the coast, let's say Gaza, that these transshippers in Gaza, they're the ones who are saying, no, this Central Negev wine, you haven't tasted wine until you've tasted it. They're selling it because they assume the risk.
Right. And they're moving back and forth anyway.
Right.
Because they're moving camels or they're moving tin or they're moving slaves or they're moving
and they're,
whatever.
Right. And they're buying ships or they're buying pieces of ships and they have consignments on ships.
Right. Well, I mean,
they're stopping by and they're saying, oh, this is good wine. We could do something with this.
Right. And then they're telling
some unanswerable questions that you guys are bringing up right now, which is, I want to know who the workers are, you know, the people who are trampling the grapes and picking the grapes from the vines. And you know, they're living in these small diffuse villages in the Negev Highlands.
Why aren't they living at Avdat or in, you know, Avdat, suburban Avdat?
Right.
Avdat adjacent.
Avdat adjacent. So they're the ones who are doing the labor. So they're working for someone or supplying someone. So, you know, how many are there stages of middlemen? I love the idea of the people on the coast. What did you guys say? Logistical expertise.
Rachel, you haven't been listening to us. We've been using those words for thousands of years.
I've been tuning you guys out for thousands of years.
Well, that's because you're smart.
Well, when you get into the whole early bronze urbanization thing, I just can't, I can't even anymore.
Have anymore.
But yeah. But in any case, I like this idea very much that they're the movers and the shakers and they're putting the effort in and they're the ones, as you said, who have the most risk. But how, you know, how many sort of down the line connections, how many middlemen are there between the people doing the labor and the people doing the selling?
Well,
I said it's an unanswerable question.
Well, he's pondering it as the New Delhi freight train rolls by.
We like sound effects in this podcast. You can just let it rip.
I've always wanted sound effects in this podcast. I figure we need to have something to sell.
Well,
trains are good methods of transport, so that would work out well.
True.
I hear they're going to make a comeback. Those are good questions, Rachel. And I would say that we don't really know, and that we've probably underestimated the number of components in these kinds of trade sequences. But that with increased refinement, scientific refinement and analytical methods, I think we're going to be getting lots and lots of insights. So for instance, the tin has already opened up the late Bronze Age to some kind of a far, you know, or a Eurasian Uzbekistan link. But how many caravanserai operators are involved? You know, who knows? I mean, we all know that when you ship something, or when you move, even something as simple as moving within the United States, that if you're not careful with the mover that you use, your stuff will be thrown into a big truck with 18 other people. And those trucks are like, you know, Uluburun. They stop at lots of different places and take on and take off and take on and take off. And unknowingly, you assume a lot of risk that your stuff is going to make it. If you pay a higher price, you get your own truck with only your own stuff that gets moved from point A to point B. But that's the most expensive way.
Right.
So you're right, Rachel. We don't know how many, different angles are operative in all of these cases. And I think you're probably right. We've probably been underestimating,
but we don't know.
I think we'll get more resolution on this as more archaeological data and environmental data gets analyzed at higher and higher degrees of resolution.
Yeah.
Well, the question of Mediterranean shipping is a kind of nautical analog,
right?
Because there are thousands of shipwrecks from all periods, and most of them probably are independents of some sort, but we also know in certainly in the Roman period, the Greeks and the Romans, there are imperial official fleets and things like that, which is sort of governmental trade. So it's a combination of all sorts of different levels, and it's very hard to categorize them, particularly since in the case of shipping, they're on the bottom of the ocean. And in the case of overland trade, the shipping itself leaves very little residue.
Yeah.
They're caravanserai. Now with, garbage middens, which are very interesting and revealing, as previously noted.
Right. That's part of the whole route, the whole shipment.
Right. But it's not necessarily the shippers themselves.
Right.
As opposed to, the way station operators.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are in different periods, forts, right, which are, official or quasi-official installations to protect frontiers and trade. So again, it comes down to focusing on the exports rather than the imports.
Right.
And the process.
And I think we need to change the name of the podcast, and I think we have to call it Ancient Globalization.
Yeah, that's a real seller, big seller right there. Get a new logo.
How about Vandalay importing exporting?
That's nice. Right. That's a winner. That's a proven winner, which will not open us up to any lawsuits at all.
I want to mention one other thing because I can't resist. And that is there was a nice little discussion of rainwater harvesting, or not a really discussion, but at least use of the term, which brings to mind, of course, Frank Herbert's epic novel Dune, and how, Dune was starting out as science fiction. Well, it is science fiction, but more and more we're getting Dune-like scenarios in the ancient world that we're now using that knowledge and information to maintain ourselves in the world today.
The one thing we don't have are giant worms.
Well, we have figurative worms that are consuming us.
Oh, that's good.
Right? I mean, you know, we have all of the tech companies. Those are, you know.
Is that the worm itself, or is that the great families like the Harkonnens and the
I think
House
the great
of Atreides?
Yeah, that's too easy. I think it's the worms. Hmm. You know, they give us this little
product itself.
Cross the spice, the melange that we so desperately need, smartphones, laptops, computer cars. But the price that we pay is that, you know, we think we can control them, but they control us.
Mm-hmm. Soon to be a major motion picture.
I was going to say, I mean, it is easy to just, you know, equate Zuckerberg and Bezos to Baron Harkonnen et al., but that's too easy. And when have we ever taken the easy route? I mean, if we had taken the easy route, would we be doing a podcast in 2023, or would we be counting, you know, rubies on our, you know, bespoke island in the Caribbean?
I would pick the latter. But that's just me.
Okay.
Final thoughts? It's hard to top a ruby yacht island kind of scenario.
You like what you like.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
do you like Retsina?
Nope. Do you?
Yeah, I do.
But do you like it because you want to like it? Like, and that, we didn't even get into the whole acquired taste thing.
That's a good point.
Right? Like mushrooms. Like, you know, how many kids like mushrooms? And how many adults love mushrooms and during moral season will pay, you know, $85 a gram for morals and, you know, things like that. We, right. You know.
Okay. Well, we'll save that for another conversation. I'm sure we'll find some other, you know, commodity that will apply to.
Did you like Retsina the first time you tried it? Did you say, whoa, what is this?
That's exactly what I said.
Really?
This is so weird and different, but wow, it's great. Huh. And a good Retsina is a beautiful thing, and a bad Retsina is not a good thing. It's like kind of licking the pavement, but it's also very contextual. You know, I had it there. I liked it there.
Exactly.
I want to go back there.
Exactly.
I've had it here. It's okay, but it's not quite the same.
Right. And that context is such a central part to tastes and smells and auditory stimulation. We love, you know, there have been studies done that people really continue to resonate for decades after them, based on the music that they hear when they're, you know, 11 to 15 or 16 years old. Earlier for women, later for men, as always. So that music that we loved when we were, you know, early young adolescents is the music that continues to resonate for us, you know, well after.
That's that's actually a good final thought right there. I just want to say that I would like them to take one of these precious 16 pips and plant it. And then we'll know exactly what we're talking about. I know Israeli wineries are trying to reconstruct some ancient wines and so on. People are doing it with beers. And
the Methuselah date.
What?
Yeah.
The Methuselah date.
I was just going to say, right, the Methuselah tree. Exactly. So I think we need to take one of these pips and plant it.
And not one Gladys Knight reference. Boy,
we missed an opportunity or what?
Yeah.
Glad you stuck in at the end.
Wow.
All right. Well, it's time to catch that midnight train to Georgia then, I guess.
Well, all I can say is, man, oh, Manischewitz, what an episode. So, as always, we'd like to thank Erez Dessel, Community Engagement Coordinator for the Chicago Philharmonic, for our theme music. You can follow him on Instagram at 54 BPM. We'd also like to thank our sponsor, the Dumont Television Network, a division of Yoyodyne Propulsion Systems. It's the only place to watch Igor Cassini's Million Dollar Showcase, Fridays at 9. To get in touch, leave us a comment. Hit the little heart-shaped button at the bottom of this page. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at this ancient, and on Facebook. Contact us via electronic mail at This Week in the Ancient Near East, it's all one word, @gmail.com, or send us a postcard at P.O. Box 1177, Boston, Mass. 02134.